Tort reform is one of those issues that's often oversimplified as a liberal versus conservative thing. You know, generally speaking, conservatives will say that they're in favor of reforming the tort law to avoid frivolous lawsuits and a drag on the economy, whereas people of a more liberal stripe will say, no, we need to preserve the right of individuals to recover for their injuries in particular cases, and we don't need to be protecting those big, nasty insurance companies. That's how it typically comes up. But today, I've got a treat for you. I've got a fellow named Brian Brooks, who is a self-described conservative Republican who is against tort reform. Yep, you heard me right. I've got a conservative who wants to argue against what's typically considered a conservative cause, and I think you'll find it a fascinating discussion. I'm Stuart Harris. It's your weekly constitutional, and it's all about a conservative's case against tort reform.
Welcome to your weekly constitutional, hosted by Professor Stuart Harris and produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier.
Tort reform is one of those hot-button issues that typically divides people along conservative versus liberal lines. And today, I've got a treat for you. I've got a fellow by the name of Brian Brooks, who's a very capable lawyer. He's a very, very distinguished career. But he makes his living as a fellow who works on behalf of trial attorneys, on behalf typically of plaintiffs' lawyers, arguing against something called tort reform. Now, that's really distinctive because most conservatives wouldn't take on such cases. It's mostly be a liberal guy. But Brian, he's got some interesting arguments, and many of them, as we shall see, have very significant constitutional implications. Now, I met Brian at a recent meeting of the Tennessee Association for Justice, which is a plaintiff's organization. They had kindly invited me to come there and speak to them, and I was happy to do so. And it was during one of those very nice after-dinner discussions that I had that I met Brian. And we'll get back to him in just a moment. But before we do, I have to set a little bit of groundwork here. I have to explain to you what we're talking about. And in order to explain tort reform, I have to explain a little bit about our existing tort system. So bear with me for just a second here. A tort is a type of legal cause of action, a type of case, of legal case, in which one party, the plaintiff, argues that the other party, the defendant, has injured the plaintiff. Okay? Most of you are familiar with that. Things like negligence, things like products liability. But the problem with most of us average folks, is that if we get injured, who are we going to call? Do you have an extra $5 or $10 or $15 or $50,000 lying around to pay a lawyer's fee? Yeah, me neither. And I'm a lawyer. I mean, I understand these things. It's kind of an interesting anomaly that a lot of lawyers would have trouble hiring other lawyers if they needed for this sort of unexpected sudden case. And so a system has evolved over the years, and the system is called the contingent fee system. And so lawyers who specialize in these sorts of cases, typically personal injury type tort cases, they will say, okay, look, you don't have to pay me, client, injured party, up front. If you come and talk to me and I believe your case has merit, I'll take it on and I'll take a risk. And the risk I'll take is that I don't get paid unless you win your case. It's called a contingent fee case because it's all based upon the contingency, which is by no means a certainty that the plaintiff will ultimately prevail. Now, as you can see, this benefits victims because victims can get legal representation without having to come up with a lot of money up front. It also benefits at least good plaintiff's lawyers, those who pick their cases carefully and make their bets very carefully and who represent their client zealously, because at the end of a successful plaintiff's case, the plaintiff's lawyer will get a fee that ranges anywhere from about 33% to 40% in most states. It varies from state to state. Now, that may sound like a huge chunk out of an award. On the other hand, you got to remember the plaintiff's lawyer has taken on a number of bets, a number of cases, and not all of them end up settling or ending in a jury verdict in the plaintiff's favor. So sometimes a plaintiff lawyer works for months or years and gets zero, gets nothing, may even have fronted a bunch of expenses and gets nothing. So you see, it's a risk. The plaintiff's lawyer takes on the risk of a case, and in return, he represents his client for free unless there's a recovery. Now, that system exists in all 50 states to varying extents, varying degrees. Tort law is primarily a matter of state law, but it's a system that a lot of people, typically on the political right, are very critical of. They don't like the system. They frequently will say it results in sort of a jackpot mentality, that you'll have frivolous lawsuits, that you'll create too much of a burden on the insurance industry, too much of a burden on the economy. They'll point to individual cases as examples of this, and the debate goes on. When they convince enough people in their state legislatures that this is a problem, they will engage in something called tort reform. So you see, we finally come to this, tort reform. Is tort reform a good idea? What exactly is tort reform? Well, that's exactly what I'm going to speak to Brian Brooks about here in just a moment. And again, he takes it on from a conservative viewpoint. Before I do that, though, I want to acknowledge something. I want to acknowledge that this is certainly an episode chock full of constitutional issues, but it's also a matter of great debate today. So in fairness, I have invited people to come on the show, including our lieutenant governor here in the state of Tennessee, Ron Ramsey, including a senator from Memphis, a state senator named Brian Kelsey, who are notable proponents of tort reform. And to this point, I've not heard back from either of them. So gentlemen, the invitation's there. If you want to come on and talk about the advantages of tort reform, that's fine. But for now, let's go to Brian Brooks and let him give his conservative's case for tort reform. And let's ask him to begin with exactly what tort reform means in the context of what I've just spoken about.
Tort reform within that context takes basic principles that we've all been governed by under the common law system. And then as the common law system says, to have developed into rules of evidence, codified rules of evidence, and codified rules of civil procedure put in books, but are generally the experience gleaned from judges over the decades for what systems make a case able to be tried in a fair way. Tort reform steps in to try to alter those things. I've written a short article for the Arkansas Lawyer a few years ago that tried to put a label on essentially what tort reform is. And I think even those who are proponents of tort reform would agree that most tort reform measures are hurdles of one sort or another that make it more difficult for the injured person to obtain a recovery, or certainly a more significant recovery than was the case in the typical common law system. To give you an example.
Before we do that, I want to get down and talk about some of these details. So the premise of people who are tort reformers, and I realize you're not one of them, and we're going to try to talk to one here before long, the premise is that if there's reform that's needed, the system's broken. So the premise is that somehow the tort system that's developed in the common law is doing what? From your perspective, what is your understanding of what the need for reform is?
Well, that's a very good question, and one that I ask a lot. One of the other things that I do is I analyze legislation and help organizations like TAJ and like the Arkansas Trial Lawyers Association, as well as others, understand what the legislation says and what it does. By nature of doing that, I find myself, although I question the wisdom of me being put in this position, blunt person that I am, I find myself often discussing with legislators or legislative bodies or policymakers tort reform issues, and what it is it does, and what it is that is being accomplished here. And one of the questions that I always start with when I sit down with one of these groups to talk about a piece of legislation is, what are you trying to do? What harm are you trying to kill, to alleviate? That's a very difficult question to answer for many of the people who bring these issues to us, and sometimes we never get past it. But when we do, what we find is that the more honest of the groups will tell you, we want to eliminate the ability of somebody to recover a large sum, a typically unfairly large sum. some of the other.
So that's the basic idea, then, is that there's something unfair about the existing common law system, that the people, the victims, are getting windfalls?
Yes, that is certainly one. And then this starts to swirl at some points, but I'll give you an example of something that I've heard, that I've been told, is, for example, physicians groups like to have what we call pre-suit notice provisions. And now, for all of you who say, what in the world is that? All it is a system by which you write a letter to the doctor who you're going to sue, saying, within 60 days, I'm going to sue you for negligent treatment to this patient, to put them on notice that it's coming. As a plaintiff's lawyer, I have held out in the past that there's no real purpose for that. It doesn't do anything other than create a procedural hurdle for a plaintiff to get over that might trip the plaintiff's case and end up with the plaintiff's case being dismissed because of a failure to comply with that particular notice provision. I have learned over the last couple of years, due to working on a task force for civil practice here in Arkansas, that they really do have a reason for asking for that type of pre-suit notice provision. It is that many providers, many insurance companies, judge whether the doctor is going to be able to bill that insurance company for services given to a patient, based in part on a point system. The point system being driven at least a little bit, some say more than a little bit, by the number of times a complaint has been filed against the doctor in court alleging negligence. Not whether the complaint was successful ultimately, but that it was filed. And so they would like that 60-day to 90-day period in which to negotiate to see if there's some way to keep that black mark from ever getting on the doctor's record. Now, there may be all kinds of other ways to skin that cat and to deal with that problem, but that pre-suit notice provision is driven, we are told, by that particular fear on the part of doctors. It helps to mine, I'm glad you asked that question, because it helps to mine down to what is actually trying to be cured in order to determine what medicine works best. I would submit to you and have to them that a pre-suit notice provision is not the best way to do it. There are other ways to do it. But that's the kind of conversation that we engage in to try to determine what it is you're trying to remedy. More often than not, however,
well, before we go on, though, I want to pause on that. So there's a sense that this is, that there are windfalls and that the existing system's unfair.
Yes.
But in contrast, the description you just gave is one that does seem to be a fairly practical concern that is understandable. A doctor,
yes,
doesn't want to be sued too many times, and if he can avoid it by negotiation, then that helps everybody. But you're pointing out that those problems can be solved in ways that are better. What would be a better way to solve that particular problem that would not involve putting a hurdle in front of a plaintiff?
How about a reform to the insurance department, the insurance code, that says that cannot be a deciding factor, a determining factor, on whether a doctor can submit charges through an insurance company?
Well, that would take care of that, and it wouldn't cost the plaintiff any money. I don't imagine the insurance companies would like it, though.
I don't know what they get from it, frankly, because I think we need a study to determine the number of times pre-suit notice actually ends up preventing a complaint. By the time the plaintiff is that far down the road, it's going to be pretty certain that it's either going to be a settlement, at which point the same black mark enters on the doctor's record, maybe worse, or the complaint's going to be filed. By that point in time, the problem that we're trying to alleviate, in other words, is already too far gone. And I don't think it's an effective method of accomplishing what the doctors wish to accomplish. All it really ends up doing is creating that procedural hurdle for a plaintiff to get over.
Okay.
Good intention or not, it doesn't work.
Okay.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and today our subject is tort reform. I'm speaking with Brian Brooks, a self-described conservative Republican who is against tort reform. Now, that's interesting. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and speak some more with Brian Brooks. Stick around. We're going to play the sue me, sue you. Could it be? Could it be? I believe it is. It is Doug the Quiz Guy Smith. Still not in his Riddler, guys. I keep waiting for the Riddler to show up, but apparently we're just going to have a straight-out quiz today. Is
we're
that
doing quizzes today.
Tremendous.
Doing a quiz.
Would we have a contestant to take Doug's quiz?
Yes, we do.
What is your name, sir?
Brian from Pittsburgh.
Pittsburgh? My gosh, Pittsburgh is showing up a lot lately in our quizzes. What a great time. What part of Pittsburgh do you live in, Brian?
About 20 minutes north, New Kensington, Pennsylvania, the birthplace of aluminum.
I thought aluminum was an element. I thought the birthplace of aluminum was in the sun.
That's aluminium.
Oh.
For our that goes back to your British show.
Oh, you're just changing pronunciations, but what do you mean? The aluminum smelters?
The material itself.
Well, I guess that's where they started manufacturing. They did a lot of stuff up there. Now, is that up? That's in the Mon Valley, isn't it?
Yeah, sort of around that area, yeah.
Okay. Well, I always learned Monongahela and Allegheny come together and form the Ohio, and I believe the Mon Valley is to the north, isn't it?
New Kensington's on the Allegheny, and then you have...
Okay, well, then maybe I've got it backward there. Okay, you're up on the Allegheny then. All right. It's a lovely, lovely part of the country, lovely rolling hills and mountains. It's always so dramatic, too, when you come through the tunnel on Mount Washington and all of a sudden the downtown is spread before you that way.
That's one of the best views there.
It really, when you come in from the airport, I just love that city. But at any rate, thanks for calling us from Pittsburgh. And Doug, do you have anything for Brian?
I do. It has nothing to do with the Steelers.
That's a darn shame.
Yes. This is a question, and I'll give you four choices. Are you ready?
Okay.
Who is the only president to become a justice of the Supreme Court?
Oh, man.
The only president to become a justice of the Supreme Court, was it Benjamin Harrison, A, B, Howard Taft, C, John Jay, or D, none? The separation of powers disallows this.
Oh.
Who is the only president to become a justice? Is it A, Benjamin Harrison, B, Howard Taft, C, John Jay, or D, none, the separation of powers disallows this.
We're looking for somebody who was both president and...
President and a justice.
Okay, but not necessarily at the same time.
Not at the same time.
Okay.
That's correct.
Well, Brian, do you have any reaction?
This is... I'm going to have to go with Howard Taft.
Why would you immediately, of those four choices, go to the fattest guy on there? I mean, this is not
a question
about obesity.
Sort of throwing a toss up there.
You're just looking for the heftiest answer then, huh?
Yeah. I'm looking for the heftiest answer here. I'm really not quite sure. So I'm just... I can remember hearing something about him. I forget where it was, but I'm going to go with Howard Taft.
Not John Jay. I thought John Jay would be the obvious one.
You thought he'd be the obvious one?
I thought he'd be the obvious
one. Was he ever president?
No.
Okay, well.
Brian, you're exactly right.
Yes, you're right.
It is William Howard Taft.
Yes.
Yeah.
And the story goes that not only was he rather hefty, and not only did he allegedly get stuck in the White House bathtub once, but he never particularly, that's the story. He never particularly, I don't know if it's true. I'm just repeating rumors. I did, however, hear that he was not very interested in being president and that he was actually sort of relieved. He became Supreme Court Justice subsequently.
Yeah, he became actually Chief Justice
of
the Supreme Court after being president. He's the only person who's served in both those, and we've never had any that served in all three branches over their lifetime. Now, that happens at the state legislative level from time to time, but it hasn't happened at the federal level.
Well, there's an ambition for you, Brian. You sound like a young fellow. You could go out, be a member of Congress, then become president, and then finish up in the Supreme Court, because that's the one you can keep till you die.
Okay, I like it. That sounds perfect.
There's a career path for you. But in the meantime,
yes,
you've won, so you get not only a pocket constitution from James Madison's Montpelier, but a YWC t-shirt, which you can obtain simply by sending us an email at ywc@montpelier.org. And give us your shirt size and your mailing address, and we will have one in the mail to you.
Oh, sounds great.
Thank you, Brian, and thank you, Doug.
You bet. Hey, it's the Constitution. I read it for the articles.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and we're speaking about a timely topic and one that's rather controversial, tort reform. Tort reform is one of those issues that's often seen as part of the liberal-conservative divide. Liberals are against it, and conservatives are for it. But today I've got a real treat for you. His name is Brian Brooks, and he's a lawyer who describes himself as a conservative Republican. He's a two-time Ronald Reagan voter, and he's very, very much against tort reform. Now, before the break, we were talking about exactly what tort reform is, and essentially it involves putting hurdles in front of plaintiffs who want to recover from people for personal injuries. Now we're going to shift slightly and talk about why or what the justifications for tort reform are.
I have not been able to identify very many instances where there is some underlying policy reason why we need to reform a particular rule of procedure or rule of evidence, other than ultimately shifting the scales in favor of the defendant and making it more difficult for the plaintiff to recover. Typically, that's ultimately the goal and ultimately the outcome of most tort reform measures, is it works a greater hardship to the person trying to recover for an injury, either in terms of limiting the amount the person can recover or making it more difficult to get to the end of the game and to get a judgment or a settlement in that person's favor.
Yeah, you've mentioned a couple of things here, and one of them is simply capping, tort caps, recovery caps. Is probably one of the most recognizable sources of tort reform. I recall years ago when I was practicing in Florida, and I did both sides of it. I defended some cases, and I represented plaintiffs occasionally. Whenever anyone would come to me with a very significant medical malpractice case, we had to look into that, because if the complaint were against any of the state university medical centers, there was a cap of $500,000, I believe it was, back in the 1990s.
Right.
And that won't cover anything if you've got someone who's suffered death or suffered major life-changing injury. $500,000, they'll eat through that in a year or two. So it effectively prevented them from seeking recompense, or it was very hard even to get lawyers to take such cases, because ultimately they were not going to be justified.
Well, and if I could interrupt you for a second, and this begins to get on my soapbox a little bit. As a conservative, I tend to be, I will confess, both a conservative and a Republican, which...
Okay, now that, just let's pause and take a deep breath and express my shock at that. You represent plaintiffs groups, and you are a conservative Republican, and you're from Arkansas, too. So this is, you got a trifecta going here, Brian.
Voted for Ronald Reagan twice and worked in his campaign when I was in college, Republican. There are certain values that conservatism speaks to for me. The value of life, the value of personal liberty, the value to hold and possess personal property, the value of accountability and responsibility. All of those things are wrapped up in conservatism for me, and for those who taught me, frankly, what it means to be a conservative and to be a Republican. back to your point about caps, a cap on damages. Typically, a cap on the ability to recover is for what we call non-economic damages.
Right.
The damages to a person that you can't put up on a blackboard and say he missed 30 days of work, which cost him this amount of money. Okay?
Things like pain and suffering.
Pain and suffering, loss of the value of life or loss of life, those what some courts call hedonic damages type measures, the loss of consortium, the loss of your dad, the loss of training and support and guidance and all of those things. Obviously, or at least I think it's obvious, those types of caps on damages have an inordinately large effect on two sets of people. Number one, poor people, and number two, moms and children, people who don't quote unquote work for a living. Historically, moms, not always now. We now have the stay-at-home dad, thank goodness. I would love to be one. I kind of am one. My office is at home. A cap on damages doesn't affect typically nearly as much the working professional as it does those who stay at home, those who are retired, those who are in nursing homes, those who are children, those whose lives are not producing an income.
That's because if you calculate their economic damages, you don't come up with a big number. So the only
you don't come up with any number.
Right. I mean, how much economic damage does someone in a nursing home lose? In fact, you could argue the opposite. If such a person were to die, then they're saving money in some sense. I'm not ascribing to that. That's a pretty brutal calculation. But my point is that you can't measure their income or their economic output, and therefore the only sorts of damages that they might theoretically recover if they've been injured or killed is those sorts that are limited by these caps.
That's correct. As a conservative, as that Reagan Republican conservative, that runs counter to everything I believe because, number one, I have devalued a life based solely on income potential. And I think that is contrary to what we preach and what we set forth and what we believe. Number two, it undercuts any notion of accountability and responsibility. You have a really good, or I guess he's still on the bench, really good trial judge named John Turnbull over in East Tennessee, who said one time in court in a case we were doing, I really think the purpose of the tort system, at least in part, is to motivate people to act more responsibly. I couldn't agree more. I think in those few words, that man encapsulated one of the conservative values that is brought forth by the tort system.
Let's expand on that a little bit, because I remember this vividly from law school years and years ago. I think the example a professor gave was shoveling your walk. If you're at home on a snowy day and you're snowed in, and you're all snug and comfy inside by your fireplace, sipping your mulled wine, the last thing you want to do is go out and shovel your walk. Because you figure, I'm not going out. It's not going to bother me. I'll just see if it melts tomorrow. But in the meantime, the mail carrier, in the meantime, the FedEx guy, in the meantime, some of your neighbors or some of the neighbors' kids may come to your house. And if they come to your house, they're going to walk on your walk, and they're the ones who are going to slip, and they're the ones who are going to fall. And that might not be enough of a motivation for you. If you're really snug in your house, you think, let them take their chances. But if you know that if they slip and they fall on your property and they injure themselves, that you are going to be on the hook, well, then you're going to do two things. First of all, you're going to call your insurance agent and make sure you're covered. But then secondly, you're going to shovel that walk. Because, if you weren't motivated enough just by general altruism, and most of us aren't motivated enough by that, human nature being what it is, you're going to be motivated by self-interest. You know that you're on the hook. And that is what I think the judge was referring to when he said it encourages people to behave responsibly.
That is precisely what he was referring to and what the value of values of accountability and responsibility arising from the tort system motivate. If, and to put it in the context of an area I know fairly well, what motivation is there to take appropriate care of the 85-year-old woman who's at the end of life and is incontinent and who really can't take care of herself anymore, if we know that the most we're ever going to have to do in terms of compensation is, and you pick up, you pick the dollar figure, is it $100,000, $200,000, $300,000, whatever it is, we can gauge our risk. And that actor, whoever it is, that care deliverer, that person who owns and operates the nursing home, that that person taking care of home health, whoever it is, can determine when the risk is outweighed by the reward. And historically, the tort system said, we're going to compensate based on the damage done, not based on some artificially imposed, pre-instituted cap or limit on what we can do.
And then, such a decision, if I can interrupt, would be made typically by a jury. So to take your example, it's a nursing home. Bed sores are a huge issue when people are confined to bed, and there are things that one can do to prevent them or to ameliorate them. I don't know all the details, but they're labor intensive and they're expensive. And so a nursing home owner, again, who's just a regular human being like all of us and who's maybe altruistic, but maybe not altruistic enough, who's trying to make a living, trying to make money, wants to make more money if possible, might not be inclined to do all that's necessary on his or her own. And if the thought of being sued comes into the picture, well, under a cap, that nursing home operator might be willing to say, well, I know I'm only on the hook for X number of dollars if this person gets a bad case of bed sores and dies from blood poisoning. So, you know, I can calculate pretty carefully how much care I have to give them and how much insurance I have to pay for that. And, you know, I'll just see if they get the bed sores.
Right.
But a person who can't predict that, a person who might be exposed to huge liabilities, millions of dollars perhaps, especially in an egregious case where a jury would look at it and say, this guy was really treating this poor old person badly, that person is going to have that incentive to make sure that the old person doesn't get bed sores, or that he does everything he can to be able to say to a jury with a straight face, I did everything I could to prevent this person from doing so, and therefore limit his liability in that way by doing the right thing.
That's correct. And as you have mentioned, the historic method for us to determine as a society what that compensation would be is the local jury, the 12 men and women who come together for this one purpose. It is, returning to the idea of conservatism, it is the essence of small government for someone like me. It's not a big bureaucracy determining ahead of time what that damage for the little old lady will be. It is people hearing the evidence in this case about this topic, about what happened here in their community, making the decision. Now, that, as I said, is the essence of small government. That is the idea behind everything local is better. And removing, you know, we hear slogans about removing Washington from our everyday lives and all that kind of stuff. But that's a real hard core example of how it works.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with attorney Brian Brooks about a controversial subject and his interesting perspective on it. The subject is tort reform, and he is against it. Brian Brooks is against tort reform, despite the fact that he's a conservative Republican.
I sued Duracell. They never told me not to shove that AA right up my nose. I sued Home Depot because they sold me a hammer, which they knew I might drop on my toes. I sued Dell Computers because I took a bath with my laptop. Now it doesn't work. I sued Fruit of the Loom because when I wear the tidy whities on my head, I look like a jerk. I sued Verizon because I get all the press anytime my cell phone is roaming. I sued
You're listening to Your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with attorney Brian Brooks about tort reform. Now, Brian's against it, even though he's a conservative. And generally speaking, conservatives are in favor of tort reform, which, briefly stated, involves making it more difficult for plaintiffs who have been injured to recover against the defendants who have allegedly injured them. Before the break, Brian was telling me that as a conservative, he likes juries making decisions about these things because juries are local, they're not bureaucratic, it's not the heavy hand of the state imposing its will on a local decision. Now he's going to tell me some more reasons why tort reform is a bad idea.
I will tell you that I believe that our society will not tolerate untoward damage to the less fortunate, that as a society we are not going to live in a world where people are injured and maimed by indiscriminate acts, that irrespective of how we do it, there's going to be a method for preventing that kind of behavior. In other words, there's going to be something that imposes responsibility and accountability. Again, through the years, it has been, for this kind of wrongdoing, for this kind of negligence, it's been a jury system and a jury trial and a damage award. Money's a great motivator, and it makes people change their positions. Well, what are we going to have if we don't have an effective, active, useful tort system? I think that's a question that we have to ask ourselves as a society, and we as conservatives really need to be thinking about, because my brothers and sisters on the right side of the aisle, right being direction right, not correct, side of the aisle, tend to gravitate toward these notions of tort reform as a solution to something. I ask my friends to think that through. Because if those juries are not imposing accountability and responsibility, who will or what will? And the list of choices is pretty narrow. Choice number one is government regulation. Now, do I need to go on to a diatribe about conservatives and government regulations? Probably not. A second choice, a friend of mine who is also a Republican trial lawyer, believes that if things move too far, what we will see is the criminalization of negligent conduct.
Wow.
That rather than a tort system imposing civil liability for money damages on wrongdoers who leave grandma in her waste for 12 hours on end and don't turn and reposition her so that she develops a bed sore, we'll begin to look for a criminalization of that very same conduct. I don't think he's very far off with that idea. I think we begin to see it in lawsuits over business fraud now that U.S. attorneys, charges that U.S. attorneys bring. We had one recently here in Arkansas that looked like a really good civil case, but they tried the man for criminal charges, and the judge eventually acquitted him after a jury verdict against him. I think my friend is on to something. And then, of course, the third alternative, God help us all, is that we start to take measures into our own hands. When grandma gets hurt, her children or grandchildren come to the nursing home and demand personal retribution, and let's hope that never becomes the system. So
absolutely not, but I can pick up on that. I would have potential clients come to me with what seemed to be legitimate concerns, and I would explain to them the limitations that they faced and the difficulty of bringing a personal injury lawsuit. And many of these people, I practiced in North Florida, which is a very, very conservative area, and many of them, like you, were conservative Republicans, and might have supported tort reform in it as a concept, and voted for candidates who supported it, and then faced themselves with such a circumstance, the disbelief and shock on their face. What do you mean? That wasn't what this was supposed to be about. That this is a real case. This is legitimate. And they would be so disappointed and so upset that you wondered whether one of them would act out of frustration and do something illegal and inappropriate against the hospital or against the doctor. They were looking for legal recourse and they weren't finding it.
I think it's a very real possibility. I think the possibility of extreme regulation or criminalization, that's hard for me to say when I stutter, of negligent conduct is those two are the more likely. But things could get bad enough for some people that they wish to take things into their own hands. The other thing that I would say to some of those who tout tort reform measures who also consider themselves conservatives, when you think about this regulatory environment, which I think is very real, I think that's a very real possibility that we would have these boards kind of like comp boards set up, and that we would have regulations on what treatments doctors could deliver at what points in time, kind of looking over their shoulders, is this. We hear particularly from medical professionals that it's this small number of people who commit all of these problems, and you've got all these jury verdicts and something might spill over onto us. I would say that if the solution becomes greater government regulation of the private practice of medicine or the private practice of bridge building or the private practice of you name it, that is going to be punishment in effect, not only to the people who aren't behaving themselves, but to the people who are doing the things that they ought to be doing every day. One of the rewards of the tort system, in my view, is that if you act responsibly, you're more than likely going to be left alone. You're not going to have a problem. On the other hand, if you make a mistake, you know what your exposure is, and that is a civil suit for tort liability. It's not the heavy hand of government intervention, and it's not the notion that I'm going to go to jail because I misdiagnosed a tumor. So I think before we throw this system out and before we hold it up as the great evil, we ought to be thinking more about what it's going to be replaced with, because it will be replaced with something other than just going on with caps in place.
But let me play devil's advocate here.
Sure.
What about frivolous lawsuits? I mean, does the system pre-tort reform, does the traditional system, does that allow for frivolous lawsuits and for windfalls for undeserving alleged victims?
I to say that it doesn't allow for it, it would be for me to be disingenuous. Certainly there are lawsuits that shouldn't be filed. There are people who do things that they shouldn't do. However, number one, people need to keep in mind that filing a lawsuit for the lawyer bringing it is not just as simple as waking up, writing on a piece of paper, and taking it down to the clerk's office and filing it. There's a significant amount of expense out of that plaintiff's lawyer's pocket, typically, that goes behind the filing of the lawsuit. You mentioned earlier that the plaintiff's lawyer is betting, is gambling, is making a bet against how these things are going to turn out and what the recovery is going to be. That's exactly what the plaintiff's lawyer has to do, because you have no guarantee of a recovery, and it's your money that's in it. A medical malpractice lawsuit, a nursing home lawsuit, a significant complicated business lawsuit, a lawsuit over a defective product is going to cost not just a few thousand dollars, but perhaps hundreds of thousands of dollars or more to prosecute. So there is a built-in disincentive to the frivolous lawsuit. Second, the lawyer and the person the lawyer represents has facing him or her the possibility of the sanction of the court for bringing a lawsuit that is not grounded in good faith, either in law or in fact. It's there and it's used, it's enforced, it's meaningful, it has weight. Could it be used more by judges? Sure. Could it be used to impose more stringent cost shifting from time to time? Sure. That's not without some merit to it. But it doesn't call for overturning and overhauling the entire system in order to reform out the what I would perceive as a small percentage of truly frivolous lawsuits to get filed. We also need to encourage our system to allow for the challenging of the status quo where it's necessary. Where would we be, for example, if simply challenging an established precedent was something that readily subjected you to Rule 11 sanctions, for your license to be at issue, for a fine to be at issue? Would we still be living, to be ridiculous, under the regime set affirmed by Plessy against Ferguson? I mean,
right. The law changes. The common law changes. We often say judges make the law, but the judges only make the law when lawyers make arguments, typically.
Right.
And in fact, Rule 11, which we've mentioned a couple of times, and that is the Federal Rule of Civil Procedure number 11, which governs ethical behavior by attorneys and also by their clients, does allow for that sort of argument. So Rule 11 will say you've got to have a reasonable basis in law to bring a lawsuit. You got to have a reasonable basis in fact to bring a lawsuit, but you can also argue for a reasonable change in the law. You could say, for example, well, Your Honor, here are the facts. Well, Your Honor, here's the existing law. The existing law doesn't support our claim, but we believe that it should, and here's why. And that's how the law changes. And Rule 11 does allow for that.
Yes. And there are measures in some states and in the federal system to beef up Rule 11. I don't have any particular concern with that. I think if it arises from the need as examined in the courts, then fine. That's perfectly all right.
But you see, that's a nuanced response to the issue. That's what I've always told my students, is that if you're concerned about frivolous lawsuits, then concentrate on Rule 11 and concentrate on encouraging judges to use it in appropriate cases to sanction lawyers who bring such claims, or their clients if the clients are lying or otherwise being frivolous. That's the nuanced response. That's the difficult response, but it's the one that will actually weed out such things over time as the law develops. As opposed, and I don't want to take your part too much on this, a relatively heavy-handed position of simply saying, well, no claim's worth more than $500,000. Or you can't have non-economic damages, or you can't do this, or you can't do that. Those sound simple, and they are, but they're simplistic, arguably.
Yeah, they are, and they, when you start mining into whether they really work, they really don't, to deter the quote unquote frivolous lawsuit. The person who's going to be out there filing a frivolous lawsuit is not going to be stopped by a $250,000 cap or a $500,000 cap. They're going to file that lawsuit anyway. There are frankly some tort reform measures that almost require the expansion of litigation. For example, the abrogation of joint and several liability, which I understand Tennessee did by judicial proclamation rather than by legislation. But here in Arkansas, we did it by legislation. Well, the effect of that is that a plaintiff has to be more diligent in suing more and more people, even those who have arguably less condemnable conduct.
We have to explain that. Joint and several liability is a concept that developed in the common law. That if three or four people or more, let's say 10 people, all together act in a way that hurts somebody, then the victim can hold any one of them responsible for all the damages. And typically that means that the victim is going to sue the deep-pocketed defendant, the defendant that has the best insurance policy or the most assets. Well, understandably, that one defendant out of the 10 is not happy about that, and that's what you mean by abrogation of that concept. They've had the law changed, and they'll say, no, you have to sue and get recovered only for the percentage of harm that any individual defendant has caused you. Well, as you point out, that means now instead of one lawsuit, we're going to have 10.
Right. We're going to have 10 defendants in the lawsuit, irrespective of what happened or whose conduct was the more egregious. One of the things that results from it, frankly, is a lot of finger pointing among people who didn't get sued. By the people who did get sued toward the people who didn't get sued and say, no, it was their fault. And so the plaintiff just has to be all the more careful to make sure everyone is brought into the suit, which is problematic for everything. And one minor addition I would state to your explanation of the concept is that the harm must be indivisible.
Right.
In other words, if five people all act in negligent manners at the same time to cause the death of Brooks, then all five are responsible for the death. You can't charge some one guy for killing the right big toe and another guy for killing the neck.
Right.
There's only one death.
And an example of that might be a manufacturer who creates a problem that the dealer fails to fix, that the local mechanic also fixes the wrong way, and then the car explodes.
Right.
Well, the driver's dead. Whose fault was it? Well, all of them had some fault, but you don't know exactly whose fault caused the problem. It's indivisible. Who are you going to sue? Well, you're probably going to sue the manufacturer and the dealer. You might not sue the local mechanic because he doesn't have any money.
Right. But you're going to have to without joint and several liability, because if you don't, that person will be tried in absentia with no defense. And the plaintiff will end up – you have this bizarre situation with the plaintiff having to defend that person, and it just doesn't work out. So he becomes a party to the lawsuit when, prior to the abrogation of joint and several liability, he might not have been.
Okay. Well, we're running out of time, Brian. One other major concern, other than the idea that some lawsuits are frivolous, that's often cited in favor of tort reform, is simply the expense. If we allow untrammeled jury verdicts, if we allow juries to give everything that they think, assuming that they can make such judgments, which is another criticism, but assuming that they can, isn't this simply going to lead to huge verdicts that are then in turn going to lead to huge increases in insurance expense and a huge drag on the economy?
Historically, no. There are some studies indicating a minor decrease in the increase of insurance rates following a tort reform measure that helps out, for example, medical malpractice suits in some way. And notice how I said that. It's a decrease in the increase. The increase didn't stop. It just didn't keep increasing at the same rate. There seems not to be much of a correlation between the two. Plus, if the trade-off is safer society, more responsibility, more accountability, in exchange for the risk that there may be an outlying lawsuit, I'll take that trade-off.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to attorney Brian Brooks for telling us why he, as a conservative Republican, is against tort reform. And hey, one more time, we realize this is a controversial subject. We always like to get both sides. We've asked the Lieutenant Governor of Tennessee, Ron Ramsey, and Tennessee Senator from Memphis, Brian Kelsey, to be on the show as well. They haven't responded yet. We'd love to hear from them. And gentlemen, you know where to find us if you want to be on the show. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our distribution engineers are Chad Barrett and Bob Hoffman. Our music is by the Watauga Fife and Drum Corps. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our Madison Minute is by the incomparable Jim Blaylock, who thinks that torts are something that you eat. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment.